Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
Hello and welcome to this new episode of Viewpoints. Boris Chassin here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, 10,000 patients in desperate need of a family doctor in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario.
So not only are we in a bad spot, but it's going to get worse.
A 1996 interview with singer-songwriter Robbie Robertson brings back memories for Six Nations radio station and community.
I hope some of that's going to work out. Thanks to you, Elaine.
I can't tell you what a thrill it was to get the call and when you called me there last week, and it was like I screamed a little bit and dropped the phone, but you were very cool about it. Once I gained my composure back.
A new Nanaimo Art Gallery exhibit looks at stories that animate us. We celebrate Black History Month by remembering Green Hill, a New Brunswick area once called the locus of Black life in Westmoreland Parish.
I thought that I had the world by the tail. And then all of a sudden, as a kid, you walk into a place and they tell you you're not welcome because they're afraid of what their customers might think.
Lucy the Lobster predicts 6 more weeks of winter. Well, 5 now. We'll tell you about Lucy and lobsters in general. It could make you think twice about your next seafood delight. Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
On X at Canada LJI and listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks so much for keeping us company this week. We have a tightly packed show for you today. First to Ontario, where over 10,000 patients in Sault Ste. Marie will no longer have access to family medicine in May. In a town of some 70,000 people, this makes up for about 14% of the population. By 2025, 1 in 4 Ontarians won't have access to a family doctor. Over 2 million people in Ontario are in that situation as we speak. Dr. David Barber, a family doctor and OMA General and Family Practices Chair, says there is no one to replace the doctors that are leaving as students are choosing other practices. Here's an excerpt from Owen Thompson's conversation with Dr. David Barber as he explores with him the larger ramifications of the growing doctor shortage.
In Canada, access to the healthcare system, happens only a few ways, right? I mean, you have to either see a family doctor or go through a merge or a walk-in clinic. And so when you take away the family doctor, from somebody, then, they have to access the healthcare system generally through the emergency room, which is one of the reasons why we're seeing the numbers in emergency rooms go up so much. And it's all being overwhelmed. There are walk-in clinics, but, there aren't as many of those either. So it's really, it's not fair to this group of people that don't have a family doctor because they don't have access like other people do. So it's something that needs to be fixed, and quickly.
Is 10,000 people who can't have access to family medicine, is that a lot of people?
I mean, that's that's a pretty significant amount. I mean, you're looking, that would be, 12, 13%, I think, off the top of my head. So, I think it's just important that every single one of those 10,000 people is going to, unless things turn around, I mean, they're going to end up with poorer health, right? They're going to end up with more problems. They're going to end up in hospital earlier. They're going to, get more sick. And so not fair to them. I think the reality is everybody should have a family doctor and access to the system. Right now, what we're about 2.2 million without, that's going to 2.5. And I've seen numbers that by 2025 in Ontario, it'll be 1 in 4 without a family doctor. So and that's the bigger issue. It's going in the wrong direction, right? So not only are we in a bad spot, but it's going to get worse.
Yeah, I believe those numbers were by the Ontario College of Family Medicine. Their prediction is that 4.4 million Ontarians will not have access to family health and family healthcare. So you mentioned that there's already being seen an overflow within emergency rooms. I read a report recently by the University of Toronto's School for Family Medicine from them that with family medicine, it's one of the fastest ways to gain access to things like prescription medicine. They provide a lot of prescription medicine. I guess, how would that affect people who don't have access to this in terms of people who need prescriptions or who are looking to find prescriptions?
Well, it's a big problem. I mean, if you just take somebody with blood pressure problems who's taking blood pressure medications, and so, you know, if they lose their family doctor, don't have a family doctor, it's going to be difficult for them to get those medications, right? You know, maybe they get them through a merger or a walk-in, you know, more of a Band-Aid solution. And I'm sure a lot of times people just stop taking those medications, right? And then, you know, beyond that, you're not picking up very simple but really important health issues like high blood pressure and diabetes, so forth, that you know, they're important to control and manage. Otherwise, people die earlier. That's just the reality of it, you know, or they end up with health problems, you know, much earlier in their life than they should be. So it's a problem.
When you first heard these numbers in Sault Ste. Marie, as well as the Ontario College numbers, were you surprised at all or worried?
Well, I'm worried. Yeah. I mean, I'm not surprised. I mean, I've been talking about this for a while now, and, you know, where I practice in Kingston, we lost 6 family doctors last summer, and I think 7,000 patients were all of a sudden without a family doctor. You know, we've been talking about this for a while. We're just not seeing any action at all. It just doesn't seem like it's being noticed by the government. So I haven't seen any acknowledgement by the government that this is an issue, right?
So how many patients typically are assigned to one family doctor?
Yeah, I mean, the average is about 1,000. I mean, I think, you know, some people would say full-time is 1,300 patients. The number that an average doctor takes is about 1,000 patients each.
So with like 1,000 patients, it seems like that even the loss of one doctor cuts off like a lot of people to get family medicine. When it comes to the individuals in these, you know, 1,000 people per doctor that kind of lose this, how does that affect them?
Well, I mean, I think it would be devastating, right? I mean, they have access to care, and they have somebody that's, you know, looking after them and making sure that they get all their health screenings for mammograms and colon cancer checks, skin checks for skin cancer, you know, pap smears, all their immunizations, all these things. And then all of a sudden they're left without any of that, right? So it's just not the ongoing health issues, but it's also picking them up. Like, who's going to pick these up if you know, nobody knows that they have high blood pressure and you're actually measuring it. Nobody knows that they have diabetes, you know, until you start looking for it, right? So I would imagine it's pretty devastating, you know, especially for the people that have, you know, major health issues, and all of a sudden there's nowhere to go.
Well, are you in that same exact situation and looking for a family doctor? Reach us at radio@frequencynews.ca. That's radio@frequencynews.ca, and tell us part of your story. Owen Thompson's in-depth interview with two doctors can be heard on frequencynews.ca.
Sago, this is Robbie Robertson, and you're listening to Aboriginal Airwaves on CKRZ 100.3 FM, the voice of the Grand.
Yahweh. We had to do that.
Yeah.
We just had to get that on. Robbie, letting us have the world premiere right here on Res Radio.
No, you did not change stations. And yes, maybe you did recognize the voice of the late Robbie Robertson, recorded in 1996 during his weekend trip down memory lane. When he went back home to Six Nations, Ontario, he was interviewed then on Six Nations Radio, CKRZ. We'll have an excerpt from this historic three-part interview later on the show. Stay with us. How can you animate the stories through art? This is a question the new visiting exhibit at the Nanaimo Art Gallery is asking. The answer, well, it's the public. The exhibit Stories That Animate Us is stealing the show out in Nanaimo, British Columbia. Jesse Birch, the curator of this exhibit, used a mix of paper and animation to bring to life a collection of oral histories, cosmologies, personal memories, and dreams. Running at the gallery until April 7th, the Stories That Animate Us features work from 11 different artists reflecting on the way stories are created as they explore the themes of culture, community, memory, death, and identity. Laurie McKenzie spoke to Nanaimo Art Gallery curator Jesse Birch about the importance of that exhibition and what it was like bringing it to Nanaimo. And she also spoke to Osvaldo Ramirez Castillo, whose work is being featured at the gallery.
It feels like a very cohesive exhibition, even though there are artists from such different backgrounds, such different generations, and such different points of view. There are a lot of deficiencies with this building because it was a former bank building. It was never made to be an art space, and so that really restricts the exhibitions we can bring. In that sense, a show like this, it has so many works in it. It can be a challenge to lay it out. In a larger gallery, sometimes everything you see separately. It's in a different room or on a different wall. And in here, all the works speak to each other. And they speak to each other so well that I think it benefits this show, but sometimes it doesn't.
When asked what he thinks people will be able to take away from the exhibition, Birch says that it's not about what they take away, but what they bring.
Well, I hope that they don't just take something away from it. I hope they bring something to it, because we all have stories. Human beings, we like evolve around storytelling. It's how we share information across generations. We all bring our own cultural stories, our own individual stories, and to be, being able to bring those stories in conversation with other stories from artists from lots of different places and lots of different points of view, I think will be an exciting experience for people.
This is Laura McKenzie.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
So during Black History Month, our journalists will be producing feature stories highlighting the Black community's contribution to Canada's history to present day. Stories such as the one that Erica Butler in New Brunswick brought back to us this week. Tantramar Deputy Mayor Greg Martin lives in Mount Watley. That's just on the other side of the Trans-Canada Highway from Aulac, in the place he grew up and where his family settled generations ago. Back then, the community was called Green Hill, and at one point in history, back to the 1700s, it was a growing Black community. In fact, it was the biggest in the region between Amherst and Dorchester, and what one researcher called the locus of Black life in the area. Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick gets hyper-local during Black History Month and brings us the stories of the Green Hill community, this time through the eyes and memories of Deputy Mayor Greg Martin.
Not many of the descendants of those Black families remain in the area, with the notable exception of Greg Martin, whose ancestry goes back 5 generations to his grandfather's great-grandfather, Peter Martin. The stories of Black families and communities in the region are partially documented online by Dr. Jennifer Harris, a former Mount A professor who wrote Tracing the Black Presence in 19th century Westmoreland, New Brunswick. Greg Martin's earliest ancestor in the region, Peter Martin, had a tumultuous life. Documents indicate he was enslaved and bought and sold by white landowners in Westmoreland Parish and Fort Cumberland in Nova Scotia. Harris writes that Peter Martin eventually became legally free, likely in 1834, when the Slavery Abolition Act came into effect. At that point, he would have been in his early 40s and had a wife, Margaret, and 8 children. One of those children was Archibald Martin, who owned land in Green Hill. Many of the Black residents of Green Hill were laborers, working for their white neighbors or walking to work in either Sackville or Amherst. Harris writes that Green Hill may have grown as a Black community over the mid to late 1800s, as Black families left or were denied land sales in other parts of Westmoreland and Sackville parishes. Green Hill became the geographical locus of Black life in the late 19th century, according to Harris, and the number of Black residents in Green Hill was rivaled only by Dorchester. Archibald Martin and his wife Millie had a number of children, including Hanford, who remained in Green Hill and had a son that would become Greg Martin's grandfather.
My grandfather, his name was Bert Martin. Him and my grandmother lived near the same land that I live on now.
Burton Martin is actually one of the main sources of information about that period in the history of Green Hill, because he kept a diary which was passed on to another grandson, Clyde Gabriel of Amherst, and then donated to the Mount Allison Archives. That's where Professor Jennifer Harris came across it. Greg Martin was still fairly young when his grandparents died, but he has vivid memories of his grandmother.
We got a treat once a month, and it was always when grandmother would go to Amherst and get her groceries. She'd find some kind of treat, a candy or something, and she'd bring it back for all the kids in the settlement.
Amherst was an important neighboring community for the Martins, and descendants live there to this day.
Amherst was the main Black settlement up on what we call the hill. in Amherst. It's up by, if you know Amherst, up by the stadium. And it used to be all black families up there. There are still some up there. I still have a cousin. Cousin Clyde's up there.
Amherst was an especially important spot for Greg Martin's parents, Sam and Mildred. According to Harris, Martin's great-grandparents, Archibald and Millie, made sure their kids had basic literacy skills, even though there's no record of them attending school. By the time Greg arrived, Green Hill kids attended school in Aulac, near where the Big Stop is today. At that time, Greg could walk right from Green Hill over to Aulac, as the TransCanada had not yet split the community in two. Martin says he doesn't recall any segregation in his school, except by age and gender.
There were maybe a dozen black kids in the school, a two-room school, and there would be, let's see, probably 30 or 40 white kids in the school. But the school was, it was divided only because they put grades 1 to 4 in one classroom and 4 to 8 in the other classroom, and that's all. And then the school at lunchtime was divided in two, the girls on one side of the school and the boys on the other side of the school.
Once he reached grade 9, Martin had a much longer trek to high school, which was all the way in Sackville at Marshview. Both his parents had also made the trek often to Sackville for work.
And we'd had to hitchhike every day. We had no school bus. And the only car or anything was Uncle Henry had an old half-ton truck. My dad never had a vehicle. He would hitchhike to work all the time. And when he passed on, Mom would be the one down on the highway hitchhiking to get to Amherst to do domestic work. As the kids, we would all line up down on the highway, and a few cars would stop and pick us up to make sure we got to the high school.
Eventually, a school bus did start coming to Green Hill, making high school less of a challenge. Martin's father died when he was quite young, and his mother remained a single parent, relying on neighbors and relatives for helping raise her kids. Martin has fond memories of the community in Green Hill. As he grew up, Martin started to attend Bob Edgett's boxing club in Sackville, along with his cousins, and eventually joined the Army. Later on, he worked at the Enterprise Foundry, where he's met his wife. They had a daughter and have been fostering kids at their home in Green Hill for decades now. Martin speaks with fondness about his community, both present day and growing up. He says racism was not a daily issue for him and was somewhat hidden, but not all of it.
Growing up, I can remember an incident where I walked into a barbershop here in Sackville, and the gentleman was very nice to me. He said, "But I'm sorry, I can't cut your hair because I don't know what my customers will think seeing you in my chair." And to me, that said a lot. It said, not only is he feeling a bit apprehensive, there's others in the community that if they saw me in a barber's chair, would be a little upset. It hurt me a little bit at the time because there I was just to join the Reserve Army. I was in a Canadian Forces uniform. I was a member of the boxing club. I was still going to school. I thought that I had the world by the tail. And then all of a sudden, as a kid, you walk into a place and they tell you you're not welcome because they're afraid of what their customers might think. Kind of was disappointing.
Martin also recalls other incidents, such as being called racial slurs. But Martin is irrepressibly positive. And even as he recalls racist incidents, he also expresses his love for where he lives.
Overall, I think that I would never have wanted to live anywhere in this world but where I live. The people, the opportunity to raise my family, to foster hundreds and hundreds of children, has been absolutely amazing.
That's Greg Martin speaking about his childhood and family history in the area of Mount Whatley, in what was once a black settlement called Green Hill. Martin is, among other things, deputy mayor of the municipality of Chanchamar.
listening to Viewpoints with Boris Sassang.
World-renowned musician Robbie Robertson passed away in August of 2023. And with this passing, former CKRZ radio host Elaine Bombery remembered she had done an interview with Robertson on her show when Robertson returned home for a visit to Six Nations of the Grand River Territory in 1996. The interview had been recorded on a cassette tape and left in a Ziploc bag for decades. Wondering if it would still play, she had it sent to CKRZ Radio to see if it could be digitalized and rebroadcast. Fortunately, it was still playable, and it sounded great. Our Frequency News journalist David Moses, also from that same radio station, met up with Elaine some 28 years later to talk about that historic moment she had with Robbie Robertson. David Moses in Oshawa, Ontario, presents Elaine Bombery's 1996 interview with Robbie Robertson. Here's how it kicked off.
So welcome home again, Robbie.
Thank you so much.
It's been a complete thrill to have you come back home and to hang out on the res and cruise on the side roads and get all dusty at the power.
No, it's a great feeling. And just this whole experience of being back here and saying hello to everybody, it's a good thing.
Yeah,
I was telling the guys when we were coming over here that... That Buffy St. Marie and the girls in Ulali, you know, all the time they're saying, oh, you got to go home. You know, everybody wants you to come and say hello. And I said, I'm going soon. And they were like, yeah. So I finally made it, and I'm really, really glad to be here.
Yeah, it's been wonderful just being part of your whole crew that's with you here.
Yeah.
Dana Perry and the wonderful gang, Hart and Troy. And now we got Shelly and Ivan as well from the bush helping us out.
So we got really some bombberries in here.
You've met a few bombberries on
this trip.
Holy
smokes, yeah. You got bombberries for miles around here.
That's right. So this whole project, the Red Road Ensemble, how did that come to be?
It came to be, I was asked to do some music for this television documentary they were doing called The Native Americans that Ted Turner and Jane Fonda were putting together. And they said, well, we're going to do this documentary and it's going to be made by Indian people. It's going to be directed by them. It's going to be people speaking on their own behalf. Nobody is going to be telling the audience what Indians are like. Mm-hmm. And I said, I like this a lot. But mainly for me, I thought something that I've been wanting to do all my life, as far back as I can remember, musically, I wanted to have the opportunity to do some music with some friends of mine that I know that are great and are so talented, but because the music that they do is from the Native community, a lot of the outside world doesn't know about it. It's always mm-hmm. been kind of a local thing. Wherever, you know how these records are, wherever you're from, people know about it, but you go a few miles down the road and people don't any longer know about that. So I looked at it like I could make this record. And it, for me, it would be like turning people on, turning all over the world, turning people on to some stuff that I know is really, really good and they've never heard before. Mm-hmm. And that's fun. It's like when you're a kid and you get a new record and you can't wait to share it with your friends. Well, it was the same thing for me. So I started calling Cashton and... the girls in Ulali and Rita Coolidge and her sister and her niece and and started just putting together like a little cast of players that I thought people need to hear. Mm-hmm. So the show that they did was done very, very nicely. Mm-hmm. They had all the best intentions, but nevertheless, for me, it was a perfect excuse to do something that I thought really needed to be done, and I want to do more of it.
Great. That's really good news.
Yeah.
That's the best news.
With some people that that we've met over the weekend here.
Good.
Some people I'd love to work with. So I hope some of that's going to work out. Thanks. Thanks to you, Elaine.
I can't tell you what a thrill it was to get the call. And when you called me there last week, and it was like I screamed a little bit and dropped the phone, but you were very cool about it. Once I gained my composure back.
David Moses and Elaine Bombery will have many more treats for you fans of Robbie Robertson. FrequencyNews.ca is where you'll find the three-part interviews between Elaine Bombery and our journalist David Moses, and between Elaine and Robbie, and a conversation also with Derek Miller. All three parts on FrequencyNews.ca.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
And good news for us as we close this show. Last week during Groundhog Day, Lucy the Lobster predicted only 6 more weeks of winter. Lucy the Lobster saw her shelly shadow on a wharf in Barrington on Friday morning. That means that 6 more weeks of winter, at least for the south shore of Nova Scotia, so 5 now maybe. Lucy made her prediction as the Nova Scotia Lobster Crawl Festival kicked into high gear. It's a whole month of celebrations along the South Shore involving the scrumptious crustacean. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, was with Lucy the Lobster and her fellow Nova Scotians.
And Lucy, what do you think? You think there's a shadow?
I think so.
What do you guys think? Is there a shadow?
Are you agreeing with us? Yeah?
Yes. All right, so if there's a shadow, that means that we have 6 more weeks of winter.
That was the sound from the wharf in Barrington Friday morning as Lucy the Lobster saw her shadow. That means 6 more weeks of winter, at least for the South Shore. Lucy made her prediction as the Nova Scotia Lobster Crawl Festival kicked into high gear. It's a whole month of celebrations along the South Shore involving the scrumptious crustacean. Nova Scotia's official winter prognosticator had a different prediction. Shubenacadie Sam did not see his shadow, which means spring is around the corner. Here's Stephanie Miller-Vincent of the Lobster Crawl to explain the apparent contradiction.
We had sunshine. I'm sorry that they didn't in Shubenacadie. We think Lucy's right. We believe, you know, we were there. We believe what she saw.
Now Lucy gets to relax for the month at Captain Cat's Lobster Shack in Barrington.
So Lucy is spending some time at the spa. You can pop in and take a shelfie with her while she relaxes for the rest of the month of February.
Well, looks like Lucy will live to see at least another winter. Did you know that lobsters can live for decades? Susan Wadey, a researcher from Fisheries and Oceans Canada, says she kept lobsters in her laboratory for 30 years. She thinks they can probably live to reach 50 years old. And some estimate that George, a 10-kilo lobster caught in Newfoundland in 2009, could be 140 years old. The lobster that was on display at the Montreal City Crab and Seafood Restaurant on Park Avenue was that same year released from his aquarium so that he could live his old age in the Atlantic Ocean. He was taken to the city of Kennebunkport, Maine, where lobster fishing is not allowed. And this completes this edition of Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists David Moses, Elaine Bombery, Erica Butler, Lauren McKenzie, Owen Thompson, and Rick Conrad. Our national editors were Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the precious help of your radio station. Comments or questions, you can write to us. Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca, radio@frequencynews.ca. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer. It was nice to have you with us again this week. Until the next challenge.